Nothing in this class.
He doesn't leave this class.
There's a big line in bold, in uppercase letters, with three exclamation marks in my notes that says, "Everyone should ask their own rabbi about what to do." Exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point. Nothing is binding over here. We're just going to look at some sources, but okay. Welcome to another edition of Why Do We Do That? This week we're going to talk about things that relate to food, a few customs that relate to food, particularly two sets of things. Hopefully, we'll see if we run out of time in the middle, then we'll pick it up next week. But the first thing that I want to talk about is this idea about not storing peeled onions, eggs, and garlic overnight, and why exactly that's a problem, and what the exceptions are, what people do about it. After that, I wanted to talk about the prohibitions against fish and meat, which we do sometimes, not to eat fish and meat at the same time or on the same plate. We'll see exactly how that goes, and also the sort of tangent prohibition which emerges from that really Ashkenazim don't practice but Sephardim do, of fish and milk. Yes, so that is a thing.
Somalis don't do that too.
Really?
They don't eat fish with milk?
No.
Is it with butter or all kinds of dairy products?
No, it's just with milk.
Just milk.
Just milk.
Okay. Yeah, tuna melts. Tuna melts. Very good. Okay. Ay, ay, ay.
I came late to New York.
Yeah, so that's not a universally Jewish thing, the cream cheese and lots. Okay, so let's start here. We have the Gemara talks about this case, about things which people do which will bring danger to them such that their life is in their hands. There are five things. A big part of the discussion tonight will be medical advice that emerges out of the Gemara, out of Chazal, whatever the sages said. How do we treat that and what do we do with it? So here we have a statement in the Gemara. Amar Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai said there are five things which if a person does them, he is responsible for his own death in terms of, we'll look at what Rashi says in a moment, but he's responsible for his own death ethically, and he should know that he's taking his life into his hands. This person, Otan mitchayev b'nafsho, so he's responsible for his own. Ethically responsible for his own death, and his blood is on his head, his blood is in his hands, it's serious. What? So you would imagine like skydiving and swallowing, whatever, what are they? We're not going to go through all of them, but the first one is ha'ochel shum kaluf u'batzel kaluf u'beitza klufa. Somebody who eats garlic that was peeled, or onions that were peeled, or an egg that was peeled, and also hashot, not that's not the end of the sentence, but shote mashkin mezugin she'avar le'en halayla, and also something else we're not going to talk about, someone who drinks diluted liquids that were left overnight in some kind of container. So the statement she'avar le'en halayla modifies both of these things. So if you eat onions, garlic, or eggs that were peeled and they were out overnight, or if you drink these liquids, what it means by mashkin mezugin is they used to transport drinks, like wine was concentrated, and they would transport it that way, because these are like Coca-Cola today. So they make Coca-Cola, right? They make the syrup in the factory, and they transport it wherever, and then they add carbonated water on the spot in the country where they're distributing it. So they used to transport wine that way. So that was transported in big canisters, but if you already diluted it down to drinking level, and you left it out overnight in the certain kinds of containers, which is not for now, that would be bad. But the other thing which is really bad, mortally dangerous, is eating onions, eggs, and garlic that were peeled and left overnight. Why is this a problem? We'll see right now. The Gemara involves itself in some other things and then comes back to this topic. So there's like a quotation, one who eats the garlic that's peeled, etc. Va'af al gav de manche besilta umetzayre v'chatime. Maybe it means because it'll be gross, because animals can come there and eat it, or a snake or some insects will come. But what if you stored it very tightly inside of a, you put it in a basket, and you sealed it, very, very well, maybe then you should be able to eat it and it shouldn't be a problem. And the answer is no. Ruach ra'ah shor alehen. So this is our old friend, which we encountered once before. The ruach ra'ah, when we talked about washing your hands in the morning, person wakes up in the morning, one of the reasons which is given for washing your hands is because a bad spirit rests upon your hands. So in this case, ruach ra, this evil spirit or this evil bad spirit, rests on the food if you leave it out overnight. Velo amran ella delo shayer behani kara no klipatan. They only said this if it's totally peeled and there's nothing left. But if they're like in an onion, it has either the peel or the coming out of the end or little hair like things, the roots. I don't know what they, right? So, I don't know what that's called. Not even, but you know, like the bottom part, it's got like a little fuzzy stuff. I think that's what it's talking about. So if that's left over, or the peel is left over, then that's okay. So it's only a problem if it's totally peeled off altogether. But if there's that part is left over, then that's okay. This is the statement of the Gemara. The Rashi that I quoted here is just to underscore how dangerously bad this is. The issue here is not that there's a spiritual problem, that you're going to eat something which has encountered this bad spirit. The context here is physical danger, medical danger, right? Rashi says, Damo berosho, his blood is on his own head, it's in his own hands. Ne nashal atzmo, he's punished for himself, for his own demise. V'chovat damo nidreshet mimanu la'achar mitato. And then he proves this from somewhere, but the price of his blood is, how do I translate, demanded from him after his death. The mitchayev benafsho, that is to say, he causes this harm to himself. So clearly, this is very serious. The Gemara took this very seriously, this issue of eating these things which were left out overnight.
You say left out overnight.
They don't have to be, the contemporary term is left out. Okay. But there's a whole question about refrigerators.
Okay, here we go.
Which we'll get to. But, So I wanted to take a couple of minutes to just talk about what is this stuff, this ruach ra'ah. The Gemara talks about some sort of bad spirit, evil spirit that's resting on the food. That sounds very, like, a little bit superstitious to the modern sensibilities. What is that? What are they talking about? And I tried to find out, and really, like, I did not come up with any very concrete conclusions. We know that the term ruach ra'ah sometimes refers to psychological state. In Tanakh, there's a story about King Saul. At a certain point in his life, he becomes very obsessed with the fact that David is going to take over. He's aware of the fact that, you know, he knows the prophet Shmuel comes to tell him about the fact that David is going to take over after him, and his children will no longer be the king. And he falls into a state of ruach ra, of evil spirit, even before this also. And this is basically described as some kind of melancholy. Like, he was upset, and people played instruments for him, and it made him feel better sometimes and sometimes not. And it sounds like some kind of quasi-depression kind of idea. And a lot of times when we find the term ruach ra throughout the Gemara and the Mishnah and all these different places, that's the reference. It's some sort of melancholy kind of thing. But there's a second way that ruach ra'ah is referred to. Clearly, in our case, we're not talking about melancholy settling down, setting in on the garlic. That doesn't mean, I don't even know what that would mean. So it's talking about something else. It's talking about some kind of dangerous thing. And we see this here just as another example here. In this source number 3, which is a different description of other things that you shouldn't be doing, other medical advice, food and drink which is left under the bed. I don't know why under the bed is particularly worse than anywhere else, but the idea is ochlun mashkin tachat hamita afilu mechupin bekli barzel. If you leave food and drink under the bed, even if they're covered with iron utensils, you really closed it off. Ruach ra shor alehen. You cannot stop this ruach ra from resting on them. Similarly, Tan Rabbanan, lo yishta adam mayim lo belele revi'iyot velo belele shabbatot. A person should not drink water during the night of Wednesday, so like Tuesday night, or on the night of Shabbos. V'im shata damo b'rosho. If he drank, then similar to what we've seen before, that is a very bad thing. Mipnei sakana, because it's dangerous. What is the danger? Mai sakana ruach ra. So we see, this is. It sounds like from this description that this is a medical issue. There was a sense that Chazal had that certain situations will create danger. It's dangerous for you to get sick. Yeah.
I think the nature of like these two or these vegetables, like onions, garlic, is that they emit a very strong odor, and it goes everywhere. So it sounds to me like it was almost like a preventative measure to ensure that you didn't eat, because the scent is very strong, and maybe it could be damaging for your health, but it does envelop, when it's peeled, it envelops the whole fridge smells of it. So it's maybe a way that
right.
Sprayed something very...
So there is a, we'll get to it, at some point, there is a contemporary discussion about whether or not onions can absorb things or get rid of things. It's coming.
It's like, if you have garlic in the, I don't know, but onions, I heard, if this child was sick,
I've never heard that either. And I was talking to someone about this, and they were like, "Yeah, that's what we do. We cut up an onion, we put it in the room, and it sucks in the bacteria." And I was like, "I didn't know that."
Right.
I've seen people. I started searching on the internet. I saw people put pieces of onion in their ears. They feel like they're getting sick. So you can walk around with onion in your ears. Garlic is very effective against vampires. that's basically what I know.
Well, it's effective. You don't see any around.
We'll have time to discuss that also, hopefully. But yes, yeah, there are curative people eat garlic. That's what my uncle used to tell me when I was. You have to eat. He used to eat like a clove of raw garlic every day, and I tried to do it once when I visited him, and it didn't go well.
You're not gonna have much luck with the women.
Give them the same thing.
Even so, okay, so we see that this is an idea here. It's a similar kind of idea. So, what exactly do we know? I tried to see if there's any sort of academic analyses of comparisons to other cultures. Maybe this something is going on. It's really unclear. It seems to be something that emerges overnight. That seems to be a pattern that we've seen. The hands happens overnight. Our case about the garlic and the onions happens overnight. Under the bed is not overnight, granted. There are other cases where things happen overnight. But it's not exactly clear what it is. I've seen at least one person say that perhaps it's just a kind of germ theory. Chazal had this idea about bacteria. It was whatever kind of idea it was. It may not be parallel or in line with our modern idea of bacteria, but they had this idea that these things become infested, they become potentially carriers of disease, and so if this happens, you should stay away from it. So the bottom line for us, though, is that this is medical advice, which existed in the Gemara, and that's what it is. The question for us today is, how do we relate to this? And obviously, modern medicine does not accept the concept of spirits descending or bad, whatever exactly this is, descending into your food overnight. We will see. I didn't quote the medical part, but I'll tell you about it, of this discussion about onions afterwards. But basically, that is not true. So what do we do now? Do we still follow this advice that the Gemara gives? Or do we say, that was medical advice, and it's not really valid now, and we should sort of move on and do and follow whatever professional medical advice exists in our day and age? So we see there that there are two camps basically that emerge in terms of whether, in this specific case, this ruach ra'a, does this still exist? Is it something we have to contend with or not? One camp we'll see here in sources 4 and 5, Tosfot, this is already an early medieval source. Here we're talking about Yom Kippur. So on Yom Kippur, you're not really supposed to wash your hands past the knuckle. It's really, you're not supposed to wash your hands extensively. But what happens if you need to feed a child? So we assume, the Gemara assumes, when you wake up in the morning, your entire hand is covered in Ruach Ra. And if you don't wash your hand, it will stay there. And if you touch food and then give it to someone, that's dangerous. So you should have to wash your hand. And that's exactly what we say. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Omer, Medicha Isha Yada Achat B'mayim V'notenet Pat L'tinok. A woman may wash one hand in water and give bread to an infant, Ve'eino Chesed, and not to be concerned about the fact that you wash your hands on Yom Kippur. And similarly, Amru Alav Al Shammai Hazakein, the elder Shammai, Shelo Ratzalach Il B'yado Achat. He didn't want to do this. He had children there that needed to eat, and he didn't want to do this because he felt he was, you know, he didn't feel it was appropriate to wash your hands on Yom Kippur. So Gazru Alav Lahachil B'shtei Yadayim. So they said, you don't want to do it with one hand, now wash both of your hands. It's really important. You have to feed children on Yom Kippur, and therefore this is totally acceptable. My Tama, what's the reason that we have to wash our hands in the first place? Amar Abaye Mishum Shivta. It's because of Shivta. So Shivta it's not exactly clear what that is. If we look in source 5, Tosfot quotes first from Rashi and then provides his own opinion. Rashi says this is a case of Ruach Ra'a. Shivta is the name of some kind of it's something not good. But the reference here is to Ruach Ra'a, to this bad spirit which rests upon the hands. So Tosfot says, yes, Rashi says this is a reference to this bad spirit, but in fact we find that in France in the 1100s, when Tosfos was writing this, early 1100s, nobody had, and this was not a practice that anybody cared about. Nobody was sensitive to this reality of Ruach Ra, so he has to explain why the common practice has shifted away so seriously. So he says, Masha olam ein nizharin achshav, bazeh. The fact that the reason why nobody is careful about these things today is lefisha ota ruach ra shor she'ein ota ruach ra shor be'elu hamalchiot. It's because whatever that stuff was, the ruach ra, we don't have any of that here in France, so there's no problem. Nobody's careful about it because it doesn't exist here, and so it's fine. So what we see from here is a precedent to say that, you know, there's medical advice which is given in the Gemara. Things that are dangerous, things that are not dangerous, and we don't necessarily have to abide by that advice because whatever was going on, whatever situation pertained in the Middle East, at the turn of whatever, in the first, second, third centuries, does not exist today. Wherever we are living today, we can't see it, so we don't have to be worried about it. And we see this idea is corroborated actually a little bit more strongly. I don't know dates, but this is a later source, the Yamshel Shlomo, and he writes that it's more than just, you know, sort of not following it. We specifically don't follow medical advice that emerges from the Talmud because we don't want people to belittle the sages, the rabbis of the Talmud, by saying, oh, they didn't know what they're talking about, they didn't understand medicine, they don't know, they weren't intelligent, however you want to put that. So he says, in that context, he mentions this issue of the ruchot, the spirits, that there's different kinds of spirits that are discussed in different places. So he says, afal pi sheyesh cherem hakadmonim, she'ein lismoch al refuot haTalmud. Even though there is a ban, a rabbinic ban, that we don't follow the medical advice in the Talmud basically at all. There are huge discussions in the Talmud, long discussions about what you should do if you get sick like this, and what you should do if you get sick like that, and they sound very interesting. You should stand in this kind of solution and eat this kind of drink, thin wine or thick wine or this kind of meat or that kind of meat or whatever. There's like huge, like it's like a medical text, but we don't follow any of that. Why? Kedei shelo lahotzi laz al chachamim makadmonim, so that people don't belittle the rabbis of the Talmud and say velo yadu sheyesh shinui b'makomot v'kol shekhen b'zmanim. People, I maybe mistranslated this. People will make fun of the rabbis. They don't understand those people that places change and times change, and so and hador potchin v'holchin, and generations become lesser. Their stature decreases over time. And so even if the original rabbis were like giants, we're only like little fleas and we don't understand things as well as they did, but people will come to say, well, since they're espousing these medical views and they're clearly wrong in our context, so we should, they're obviously not very smart and they don't know what they're talking about. So he says, so also, gam mashis hiru mishum rucho, what they warned us about in terms of these spirits that rest on things, kulon lo shchiach edna, none of them are found today, no, we don't know about them. Nevertheless, he says, "Mashiach lechush minin kshafim v'hezeko shibegufo lemeichash bai." Whatever concern, you know, if it doesn't hurt, and there might be a concern, so then, and it has to do with your physical body, it has to do with the damage or whatever. So perhaps we should still be concerned and act in accordance with what they said.
You know, sometimes you have to put these things in context. Like, you know, we have the luxury of having fridges and freezers and things that, you know, you can safely store things that are peeled or cut. But,
yeah.
You know, without that, and especially in a warm country, you can well imagine that, you know, leaving things like peeled onions or peeled garlic with the fact that they ferment, you know, very quickly, that, you know, and cause all sorts of things. Despite the fact that they have to call that situation ruach ra, in other words, it brings on bad things. It perhaps is a way to either scare people to not to do it so that they avoid getting sick, or to put a label on something to say that, you know what, in order to maintain good health for you and your family, blah, 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 these are things you should avoid.
Right.
No other reason than simply that.
Right. So I'm not even sure that the phrase ruach ra was meant to imply a spiritual something. I mean, it's not clear. I don't have good context on what the medical ideas were. But they didn't have germ theory, right?
Is that why we wash, though, when you pluck a fruit from a tree, you have to wash it first? Is it because of ruach ra as well?
If you pull fruit from a tree, you have to wash it before you eat it?
You have to wash it before you can eat it.
I'm not aware that that's because of ruach ra. It is a good idea. Pesticides are bad. But I'm not aware. It could be true. I'm not sure. But I'm not sure the term, it depends how they understood medicine, right? I'm not an expert. I know a little bit about Greek medicine, but that's about it. I think this may not have even been the same, right? The assumption in Greek medicine is that you had humors, different fluids that compose, had to have certain ratios in your body. But it could be very well be, this is how they understood. People get sick from eating things. Why does that happen? We don't know about bacteria. We don't know what a virus is. So it's some sort of bad spirit or something that you ingested that you now have to deal with. It could be that that's all that's going on. In any event, what Rav Shlomo Luria is arguing is that someone comes to the rabbi and says, "Rabbi, like, you know, I have pain over here." He can't say, "Oh, well, let me just open the Talmud and I'll you should stand in a pool of this whatever, and you should drink this kind of wine and it's no problem." You shouldn't do that. That's bad. It's just not a good idea, and it's dangerous. But if there's something which doesn't hurt, look, after all, you know, it's an onion, so I'll leave a little bit of peel in the onion, or I'll do something. And after all, Chazal said it was dangerous, so that, and it's bad, it could be very bad for me, so then maybe it doesn't hurt to maintain that, even if we're not going to rely on this, you know, when the stakes are really high. That's his assumption. On the other hand, there are many other poskim, many other legal decisors who assume that this is really totally in effect. This rule about ruach ra, even if you want to look at it from a technical halakhic perspective, that they enacted this rule that you should not eat these things, it's clearly not a good idea. So that rule is 100% in effect to the present day, with no exceptions. In fact, we find, I mean, there are exceptions. There are five of them, actually. But there are exceptions to the rule, but we'll talk about them in a minute. We find in the Shulchan Aruch, when we try and look for this rule, that it is mysteriously missing. The Shulchan Aruch has a list of different things that you shouldn't do because they're dangerous. And after, we'll see maybe later what the Rambam's view about doing things which are dangerous is. And we'll look for it, and we'll try and read it, see if you find it. It's not in here. This issue about onions and garlic and eggs is just not in the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch says, "Tzarech lizaher militein maut bepiv." One of the examples is you shouldn't put money into your mouth, which is a very good idea. Shema Yeshalehen rok yavesh shel mucheshin, because maybe there's dried saliva from a sick person on the money, or you know, any host of other things that could be on the money. It's definitely a good idea not to put money in your mouth. Then the Rama adds, v'chen yizahir mikol dvarim hamidim lidei sakana. In general, a person should be careful to stay away from things that put you into danger, which is very sensible. Ki sakanta chamira meisura. This is important. I added this here because it's just important to note, like think about it. In general, danger in our perception halachically is more serious than doing something that's forbidden. It's more serious than eating something treif or whatever. Yesh lachush yoter l'safik sakana milasafik iser. And we should be more concerned about the possibility of something dangerous happening than the possibility that something's forbidden. And so this is taken in interesting ways that, you know, in let's say in terms of kosher food, there's a concept of bittul berov. Something is mixed in with the majority or mixed in with 60 times the amount of the thing which is not allowed. So we say that's gone and you can forget about it. There's something that you can't eat because it's dangerous. It might be poisonous. So 1/60th, if it's 1/60th anthrax, I'm still not going to eat that. Right, so if it's dangerous, that this statement of the Shulchan Aruch is taken in this way, that you should be worried more about the possibility of danger than the possibility of forbidden things. V'lechen, therefore, what comes out of this? What are some examples? It's forbidden to walk in any place which is dangerous, like under a wall which is unstable, or to walk by yourself in the middle of the night, in a place which is not safe. And similarly, chen asur lishtot mayim min hanarot balayla, you shouldn't drink water from a river in the nighttime. Okay, ola niach piv al kiluach hamayim lishtot, if there's water flowing from somewhere, you shouldn't put your mouth onto that place and drink from there. Ki dvarim elu yesh behen chashash sakana, these things have the potential for danger. There's other applications too. If you go skydiving, that's pretty dangerous. So maybe that's not a good idea. And there are people that will tell you, rabbis that will tell you, you should not go skydiving because you're supposed to stay away from doing things which are dangerous. But what we don't see here,
and dangerous professions too, you're supposed to stay away from those too.
Right. If you're putting yourself into danger on a
how about the IDF?
So that's a very different situation because there it's not. It is dangerous, but you are doing it for, you know, mitzvah purposes or self-defense purposes. If you don't want to count it as a mitzvah, whatever, there's a pragmatic reason. But to simply do something flippantly to put yourself into danger, that's not appropriate. But what we didn't find in this list is our case of the onions and the garlic and the eggs. So it sounds like the Shulchan Aruch thinks this is not a problem. At the end of the day, I mean, I didn't do a poll, but many of the kashrut organizations, and certainly in America, I didn't check with Korah's heart. It's harder to find sometimes like their positions on things. I have to talk to people, this is considered a real issue. The OU in America considers this to be a real issue, and it comes up in interesting places. Let's say there's a company that makes deviled eggs. And they want the deviled eggs to be kosher. You package that, how you deliver deviled eggs, but they do that. You can buy deviled eggs in the supermarket. Or you have, apparently, because it happened. I mean, maybe they went out of business and that's why you can't find them. Or you have a company that produces egg powder. Like, you know, you can reconstitute the eggs into scrambled eggs. Or something like that, where these people clearly have eggs that are left out overnight. And in lots of different food situations, egg salad, sure, we don't, yeah.
There's garlic powder and onion powder.
Right, and then there's garlic powder, onion powder, basically anything where you're cooking, you're going to have onions or garlic that's going to be left processed, you know, it's going to be peeled overnight.
It's not an onion, and it's not a garlic clove, and it's not an egg.
What is it?
No, if it's dried, it's no longer...
Okay, so very good. So this leads us to the potential exceptions to this rule. But just so you know, that this is taken seriously. People deal with it, even though it's based on Ruach Ra, and even though there's sources to indicate that that's not something to be concerned about, we are concerned about it, maybe not in the most extreme way possible, but certainly we are concerned at a basic level. So what are exceptions to the rule? So a couple of them we saw. Maybe only one of them. One of them is mentioned in the Gemara itself, which is, we saw that if the hairs or bits of the peel are left on, then that's enough, and you can, and there's no problem, and you can leave that overnight and continue to use it, and that's not an issue. Another possibility is if you mix in other ingredients. And this is what people do sometimes. You cut an onion and you put little drops of oil on it, or you put some salt on it. I saw that, I mean, again, all of this is, none of this is practical. You should not rely on it, practically speaking. But I saw that the idea is that the other ingredient has to change the onion in some way. You can't just put like some water and say, oh, I put water on it, done. If it's salt, so it'll change the taste a little bit, or if it's oil, it'll change the, maybe also change the taste a little bit. So that's what people do. Sometimes people do that. They put a drop of oil on it, or a little bit, and then it's fine. Also, if it was peeled during the night. So this is one of these cases where you use the technicality, because, and it's based on the fact that we don't really feel like this is necessarily a huge danger. It's something that we're careful about anyway. So maybe it's only a problem if it's out the whole night. But if I peeled it during the night, so it didn't sit the whole night, it just sat for part of the night, that would be okay also. Dried, things that are dried, so as you mentioned, if something is dried out, then it's not considered to be this, have this issue of ruach ra. And also commercial goods, this is the most interesting one. This was a question that was put to Rav Moshe Feinstein, because there are cases where they had commercial, like factories where they had onions out overnight. They weren't dry, they weren't mixed, they were just onions, or just eggs, or just whatever. So he felt, and there's basis for this, but he felt that something which, there's a Tosfot that seems to say, that something which, where you planned to keep it overnight, or for several nights, or whatever, when you peeled it, for whatever reason, that's okay. I don't really understand that. But that's the assumption, and so on that basis, it says things which are produced commercially, where it's clear that it's not, the point is not to eat it right away or to eat it the next day or whatever. It's only going to be eaten in the future. That is okay as well. Okay, so that's the idea. In terms of popular culture, there is this idea that onions absorb. I wanted to see if there's any basis for this. So there's this idea that onions absorb stuff from the air. So I don't know if you've ever heard of Snopes.com. There's this website where they debunk myths. It's called Snopes.com. So they usually have very good sources. So this is from there. They quoted from this dictionary of superstitions, people having this idea in the past. So the numbers there are the years. The onion is cut up. This is instructions for what to do when your child is sick. The onion is cut up and stood in an old tin plate. When you place it in the room, and then you place it in the room where the sick child sleeps, the onion draws the complaint into itself, and when the child is better, care must be taken to see that the onion is properly burnt. So in this case, and in the next one also, special small onions are being grown for me, as I am liable to keep half a cut onion from one meal to another, which I am assured is highly dangerous. So you see this happening in both directions. On the one hand, the onion is considered to suck in bad things and you get rid of it. The other, I mean, it fits, it's a corollary, but to keep cut onions around because it sucks in bacteria or whatever bad things are in the air is very dangerous and you shouldn't do it. And recently, more recently, in 20, I think it was 2015, a few years ago, somebody published a blog post where they had gone on a tour of a factory, and the person who was like the food chemistry expert there was explaining how onions are really bad. They're always the first things to go off when there's an epidemic. They look to see, you know, if some sort of virus, they look to see when the person ate onions, and it created this whole scare that onions are somehow like magnets for bacteria, and that's really bad. It doesn't appear to be true. I mean, I read a couple of medical responses, including this one from the National Onion Association. Mm-hmm. So that you know that they're for sure not biased. Yeah. This is a very detached scientific opinion. But the idea is that it could be onions are a good one, once they're cut, are a good area for bacteria, an environment where bacteria can flourish. Bacteria apparently don't just like move through the air. They're spread through contact. So the idea that the onion sucks the bacteria out of the air is apparently not reasonable. And so they said here, there's not any scientific basis that cut onions are a magnet for bacteria. According to the Center for Food Safety of the University of Georgia, juice released from cut onions the opposite. It is known to kill or inhibit the growth of several types of microorganisms, including some capable of causing human illnesses. When cut, onions release compounds that do not promote pathogen growth. This is the same compound that causes our eyes to produce tears. When handled properly, cut onions can be stored in the refrigerator in a sealed container for up to 7 days. Okay, so the, scientifically we assume that this is not true, but it is still the case, as my friend apparently does, to put onions out when people are sick, and it sucks in the bad stuff. And that is an assumption that people make. So this is basically what we have. Refrigerators don't seem to be... I mean, there was somebody that said maybe refrigerating would be okay, but in general, it doesn't seem to be accepted. And this is basically what we have in terms of onions. So we have this idea that cutting up these things and leaving them overnight, in terms of the way that Chazal understood medicine, creates a medical danger. And then we have to pick up the pieces now and figure out, given that we don't seem to observe this medical danger, what to do. So some opinions say we don't have to worry about it because it doesn't exist. And other opinions say it really is a problem. And nevertheless, everyone agrees that we should be concerned at some level. And so that is the basis for this practice of being worried about the cut-up onions and garlic and eggs. Okay. Questions, comments, concerns.
What's with the water on the fourth night and the Shabbos not drink water at night?
Yeah, I can't pretend to explain all of these cases, but there is also considered Ruach Ra. I don't know why Ruach Ra appears on Tuesday night and on Friday night more than on other nights of the week. I don't know if that's not a lunar thing. I don't know, but apparently it does. And people with the Gemara provides you with ways. What happens if you're thirsty? I sometimes want to drink at night,
right.
Water. So it has all kinds of things you can say or ways you can do it that will alleviate the problem. But it all comes back into the same question of what do we do with medical advice that we find in the Gemara.
Well, we have a tradition in our family to break the fast.
Mm-hmm.
We have hard-boiled eggs,
mm-hmm.
and they're made before the Yom Tov.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're all peeled before. I mean, we're not religious, but I think it's probably back from, I don't know, it's like a tradition. I guess that's
right.
Wrong.
I don't know. If you keep it in with some salt water or whatever, then it may not be a problem, right? Well, if there's other ingredients mixed in, so it might be okay. I'm not sure it works in terms of the egg, because the egg is not cut up, right?
It's just a whole egg. Put it in salt water?
I don't know for sure, but I would guess that something like that, or you put if it's like already set up. Right. But if there's other ingredients that are there, then it could potentially be okay. Or if you leave a bit of the peel on, also could be okay. Yeah.
But if the egg was prepared the day before.
Yeah, so that's part of this concern. Also on Pesach, I don't people, my
yeah.
family, we
right.
boiled
right.
eggs.
Yeah.
So
right.
I don't know when those are prepared, but that's all of those things fall into this category. So I hadn't heard of this for a long time.
So who does this?
I mean, I think people do it. As I said, it's a real concern. Just people, a lot of people don't know that this is a reality, that this is something that there is to worry about. It could be that I didn't do an exhaustive search. It could be that there are even contemporarily people that say that you don't have to worry about it and it's just fine. I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah, but there is. But
I wouldn't be surprised.
To Maggie's point, there is a bit of a difference between letting, even putting an onion or garlic that's been peeled in a basket, covering it, and putting it in a Ziploc bag and putting it in the fridge. I mean, there is this issue that
right.
you're hermetically sealing the receptacle of where that item is being stored. There's almost negligible chance of any infection or any type of bacteria coming to it for that time being.
So,
whereas if it's left open, a cloth cannot protect.
So 100%, and I did see that somebody suggested. Maybe, certainly in terms of eggs, once you hermetically seal it, maybe that just counts as putting it back into the peel, into the shell, right? That's the same thing as you just made an artificial shell, but even that person didn't rely on it in the end. He thought maybe this is true, but it's not clear. So this is something you have to ask about. I don't know. I know some people, certainly in terms of onions, I've never really encountered people being really careful about this in terms of eggs.
I know if you cut an onion like with a fleshing knife, the onion.
Right. So that is a straightforward halachic issue. That the food will become fleshig. If you cut it, the onion will take on the qualities of fleshigness if you cut it with a fleshig knife.
And radishes too.
Radishes as well, sharp radishes. There's a whole question about radishes. You asked about radishes before. Some people say radishes are included, but they're not in any of the sources, right? It doesn't talk about radishes. In that other case, it's specifically related to sharp foods. But there, it's not an issue of danger. It's a concept in halacha that if you have absorbed taste or whatever inside of a utensil, it can be extracted by cutting it through something sharp. So that's not a danger issue. That's a straightforward halachic issue.
Did anybody do any research on this? You know, this one of the third point of the Talmud, the Babylonian Talmud, where does it have anything to do with like what God created on the fourth day, or on the fifth day, and versus what he did on like the rest? I mean, does it have any? What context can you put on those things?
It's interesting. I didn't really look into that point so much because it was sort of tangential, but I'm not sure. I have to look. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be surprised. I don't know. You have to explain it somehow. Clearly there must be some context out of which that statement emerges. They didn't just say, hey, you know what? I feel like Tuesday nights are not good nights for water.
Well, just like
Shabbos night, not a good time for water. There was some reason for it. It was there's a method there, which means it's based in some kind of belief. It could be based in some sort of Torah kind of thing. It could be based on the cultural understanding of medicine at that time.
Just like, you know, getting married on Tuesdays, you know, Pamayim Ki Tov, two things were created, so it's a double myth.
That kind of stuff that's true. That's true. There are other reasons for those halachas too, but yes, that's true. That's this idea. If everyone's okay, we'll go on to fish and meat. What is fish and meat? We know that you're not supposed to have meat and milk. That's bad. That's in the Torah. The Torah says something about meat and milk. But what we also encounter sometimes that, you know, you're eating somewhere or you're eating and there's fish, and then you have to take the plate off that you ate the fish on and the utensils that you ate with the fish and either rinse them or you use a different plate. And there's some people like to drink something in the middle or eat something in between the fish and the meat. So what is this about? Where does it come from? So the answer is that it is closely related to what we saw before. It's also something which is considered dangerous. It's medical advice that emerges out of the Gemara. So we have this source number 10. Hahi benita di'itva behade bisra. If you have a fish which was roasted together in close proximity to meat. Asra rava mifarzekia lamechle bekotcha. So rava of Farzekia, which is a place, forbid it from being consumed together with kutach. Kutach was a popular dip in the Talmudic era, which was made out of molded breadcrumbs, molded chunks of bread, and whey, or curds. I can't remember if it's curds. I think it's whey. It was whey and like moldy breadcrumb stuff. It was very good, but apparently, I think there are other places where it says it doesn't make your breath smell very good, and maybe it's not so healthy. But it was a very popular dip called kutcha. But kutcha is milchig, right? Because it has whey in it. So this first statement of Rabbi Farzekia is saying, if you cook the fish in the same oven close to meat, then for whatever reason, I don't want to get involved in what the concern is, maybe you shouldn't eat it with milk. Okay, that's the first one. Okay, so that's non-controversial. Mar baravashi amar afilu b'milcha nami asura. You can't even eat it in salt. You can't eat it at all. Mishum dekashya l'recha u'ladavar acher. Because this fish, which was cooked in the oven together with meat, is problematic in terms of bad breath, and also in terms of something else, the other thing, which actually this gives a reference to leprosy, to tzara'at. It can cause tzara'at. In this case, we know. So that's pretty bad. You don't want to get... I mean, it's not clear that tzara'at is leprosy, but it's some sort of not good disease that you don't want, and it's better off not to have. So it could be problematic. Okay, great. So now what do we do with this? So I just quoted you for you here. I mean, we could have talked about it before, but here's good too. This statement of the Rambam about the things which the Chachamim said, which the rabbis said you're not supposed to do because of danger, and how you ought to comport yourself. There are many things the rabbis said you shouldn't do because they're dangerous, mortal danger. Somebody that says, you know what do other people care? I'll endanger myself and I'll do what I want, and you know, don't bother me. I don't care about this, I'm just going to do it anyway. You punish him with lashes of rebellion. Lashes for rebellion is a punishment which is derabana. Normally speaking, you get lashes, that's if you violated something in the Torah. If you violate rabbinic decrees, you get lashes for rebellion. And the Rambam is assuming that these statements about health are included in that category. So it's serious. You have to be careful about your health. You're not allowed to be flippant and say, it's not a big deal. Okay, so how do we proceed in terms of our fish and meat situation? So here we see the Torah says, "Tzarich lizaher shelo lachol basar v'dag biyachad shekasha l'tzaraat." Person has to be careful not to eat meat and fish together because there's a problem in terms of leprosy. What I translate as leprosy, it's probably not so accurate. Yesh machmirim bedavar leached ledagim kelim levad. And some people are careful to have a separate set of dishes and utensils to use with fish. So you can just imagine that the size of the kitchen will now multiply because there's milchigs, fleishigs, and fish. V'adonia v'yarosh, his father, can you imagine? And parv and Pesach and whatever. The Rosh said, Haya ragil lirchotz yadav bein basar ledag. He would wash his hands between eating meat and eating fish, and he would also soak some bread in wine or some kind of liquid, in this case wine, and eat it, so that would count as washing out his mouth, and then he'd be ready to eat the fish. So he would make a complete separation between the meat and the fish. So this is what we see here. Yeah. So the fish is parv. If you can have,
you just can't eat them together.
In terms of the basic laws of meat and milk, fish is parv. Mm-hmm. Now we're talking about, this comes back to that same divide. Meat and milk is a halacha that the Torah said, you're not allowed to eat meat and milk. It's not necessarily a medical statement. People like to interpret it in all kinds of ways, but it's just a basic rule. You're not supposed to eat meat and milk. Now we're talking about, and in that world, fish is not meat and it's not milk, it's just parv. Now we're talking about other issues which emerge out of potential danger. So you're mixing the things together, it could be dangerous. Yeah.
It would be problematic for a culture that was cut off, that didn't know of these teachings, and who always ate fish with meat and fish with milk. On the condition you couldn't eat fish with milk, but even eating fish with meat. Because these came, and maybe it was localized, and it came maybe so late after that.
You're saying Jewish communities.
Yeah.
So in this case, the source is in the Talmud, right? The source number 10, where this derives from, is in the Talmud, and the assumption is the Talmud is basically ubiquitous.
But that's if you're roasting it. So my point is, if you boil it, or if you you boil the meat and you roast the fish,
correct.
You're putting them in the same oven, so therefore, theoretically, according to this, you could eat them together. But we extrapolate that, since that was probably the mode of cuisine in that part of the world, then obviously that was the only way to prepare it.
Correct.
But
so that could be true. I think historically speaking, subsequently, the Shulchan Aruch was also basically universally accepted. So really, it's a post-Shulchan Aruch kind of question. Things which emerge after the Shulchan Aruch was...
The people in Yemen didn't have...
That's true. People in Yemen did not have the Shulchan Aruch.
So, I have to ask my friend, but...
Did they? I'm not sure. But they don't follow it now. That's for sure. Not totally in any event. That's true. So, okay. I grant it. So that's true. The minutiae here would probably not exist for certain people if they weren't following in this line of custom. So the Rosh was very careful, and he used to separate between he would make sure to wash his hands and so on. In the Shulchan Aruch, we do find this brought down. As opposed to our previous case, which was not included, here the Shulchan Aruch includes it. Tzarich lizaher shelo leachol basar v'dag mipnei shekasha l'tzaraat. You should be careful not to eat meat and fish together. Yirchotz yadav bein basar ledag v'yochal pat sharui bein tayim kedei lirchotz piv. And he follows through with this idea that you should wash your hands in between eating. It's like the end of page 2, the beginning of page 3. The Hebrew is on page 2, the English is on page 3. He follows through that you should wash your hands. In terms of Ashkenazim, the Rama says that it's not necessarily true. Yesh omrim de'ein lechush laze rak kishim mevashlim yachad ve'ochlan. The only concern that we have for fish and meat really is when you cook them together and eat a combination of the two things. But avala ochlan zeh achar zeh ein lechush, to eat them one after another, that's not really, you don't have to wash your hands in between and so on. V'chen noagin shalol yirchotz hapeh v'lo hayadayim b'neihem. And so we're in Ashkenaz, their custom was not to wash your hands and to have to wash out your mouth. However, what's appropriate to do is to eat something in between or drink something, because then that's considered like in terms of eating meat and milk and then or cheese, and then afterwards having meat, this is normally the rule that you have to do, to wipe out your mouth and to rinse it out. So if you eat something and you drink something, that's enough, and then you can have fish. So that's what some people do. That's a good time for scotch, that you find certainly people do that. Schnapps, some kind of schnapps that they have at the meal. In terms of just how we approach, so the Shulchan Aruch is assuming this is a real issue and it's a danger. We see just in terms of the, I stopped numbering the sources. That's good. What would have been source number 14? The Magen Avraham says, "Efshar de mizman hazeh ein sakana kol kach." It's possible that in terms of this meat and fish issue, it's not so dangerous today. The chazin on kama dvarim hamuskarim begmara shem sakana leruach ra v'shar dvarim ve'idnu anu einu mazik. So, because we see that there are many things in the Talmud, like Ruach Ra that we discussed, which are mentioned, which don't cause any damage today. The Nishtanu Hatvayot, V'gam Hakol Afiyat Teva Haaretzot. Because maybe nature has changed, or whatever, for whatever reason, this statement of nature has changed caused a lot of controversy. But for whatever, I think, you know, at a sort of in a less controversial way, what he's saying is we don't exactly know why. We're in different countries, we're in different circumstances, but whatever seemed to be affecting the rabbis in the Talmud doesn't seem to be happening so much now. So basically that sort of informs the terms of the fish and meat thing. I don't want to go into the detailed halachas, but it is a real concern that people have. Several of the questions we discuss come up. Do you treat this as a real issue? Do you treat it as something that is probably not actually dangerous, but we still follow it because we, you know, want to be careful just in case? What about the question of bitul b'shishim? Can it be nullified in 60 parts? So there are two views. One view says, yeah, because it's not, it may not really even be a real concern like we see here. Certainly we'll just nullify it in 60 parts. The other view takes the side that we mentioned before, that since this is danger, it's not like kashrus, it's not like a kosher question. This is a danger question, it's a poison question. So just like you wouldn't eat poison if it's in 60 parts, you don't eat this if it's in 60 parts either. So you just don't eat it. If fish falls in, it's not nullified and it's a big problem. As far as I know, we hold like the view that it can be nullified, but it is a real concern that people have. And I didn't see exactly who brings this down precisely, but the custom of being careful about the plates, the utensils, is also something that became prevalent.
So, to rinse it. Worcestershire sauce, they put on the back, if you read the label, it contains fish.
Right.
Because, you know, a lot of people would have put it in roast beef or something like that, you know, but you know, obviously it was important enough, so they put...
Correct. So yeah, and the concern there is if it's diluted less than 60 parts when it's made, then basically the assumption is that some people are concerned about it.
Worcestershire sauce? I don't know.
They have
yeah. If you want real Worcestershire sauce that has real anchovies in it, which is kosher, but we're sort of not permitted to put that in.
So if they make it, I think what I saw was that if they make it in such a way that's already been diluted in less than 60 parts.
But do we don't know that?
We don't know that. So I think the OU's policy, and this could be mistaken, was as follows. If it's something which is diluted less than 60 parts, then they don't write OU fish or whatever on the label. you can, if you're one of the people that is concerned about this view which is of the Taz, that you have to be worried about it even in less than that amount, then it's written on the label, and you'll see that there's fish in there, and you won't use it. And otherwise, everyone else can just use it. It's normal kosher. There's no problem. You can use it with meat. If it has more than 60 parts, or the fish ingredient is not written on the label, then they will write, OU, fish. And then it's a concern, because you're not allowed to just dilute it yourself, right? Yeah, you can't create a diluted situation. Here, there's a little bit more leniency than in other cases, but so there are two situations that could actually be happening when you see OU fish. One is that it's more than 60 times, whatever. It's a higher ratio than 1 in 60, and therefore you shouldn't be using it with meat, and Sephardim that are concerned about fish and milk, I don't know exactly the fish and milk situation, or it could be that it's less than 60 parts, it's just not mentioned on the label, in which case it's really okay.
I have to see if it's mentioned on the back, then the list
yeah. This is the policy of the OU, again. So core could be different. It. I'm not sure it's
so
the
I
same.
So I don't buy it with the fish.
Pardon?
I don't buy it if it says fish on the back, because I use it for meat.
Right.
You always use this one recipe
so,
that has it.
So I think this, if I'm not mistaken, that makes sense, because it could be that it's at a concentration which is higher than 1 in 60, and then it's a problem.
So
to
then,
put it onto the
if
meat.
You're serving a buffet, and you have herring, and you have meat chillet, all on one buffet table, you shouldn't have it at one buffet table.
So we tell
people here that please, you know, if you're having, because we're both, please make sure you change plates.
Right. So I think that in terms of meat and milk, there is a rule like that. You're not supposed to eat meat and milk
at
the same table.
We don't permit.
No. But if you have like a herring.
Fish and
meat. Yeah.
Fish
so
and
that's
milk,
in terms of meat and milk, there's that concern. I'm not sure, but that's a secondary rule, right? The basic rule is eating. You're not supposed to eat them together. The idea that they're on the same table is not. And as far as I know, in terms of fish and meat, there's no prohibition of having them on the same table. You just have to be careful. The issue, the maximum extent is people are worried about using the same utensils before they've been rinsed off. Once they've been rinsed off, it's not. You know, it's not like you need special. We don't hold that you need special fish. Kalim or something.
There's no prohibition against it. You just have to know not to.
Right, so you just have to be careful to be not use the same plate, basically, and fork. Okay, so we're out of time. Fish. Yes, sure.
Some of the prohibitions mentioned earlier, it just occurred to me reading somewhere that the carbonus, for example, if you couldn't eat it at night, it had to be finished in the morning. If you couldn't finish in the morning, it had to be destroyed.
Right.
And there's some reflection, some of the prohibitions over here. Now, at that time, they didn't know about hygiene. We know very well now. If we leave meat out, if we don't eat it by the morning, it's inedible. That
right.
Perhaps some of those thoughts occur in some of these prohibitions here.
It could be. It certainly seems like, for sure, the things we've been discussing today are based on some kind of hygienic medical concern. Whether or not korbanos are also based on that concern.
You could say the honor, the kavod of the korban, you know, was.
Yeah, so
not
whether or not the
anymore.
Korbanos are also open to that kind of interpretation, it's possible. Certain people are more inclined to do that and certain people are less.
Yeah.
But what's clear is for sure, you're right here, this is the issue. The issue here is hygienic and medical as opposed to spiritual. I don't want to keep any. I'm very happy to talk about it, but I don't want to keep anybody here.
I need my
locusts. Okay.
Okay.
So.
Look good.
So what we'll do is I don't want to keep anyone here. I'm happy to discuss this with whoever if people want to stay. Okay, so we'll look at it. The fish and the milk. There are certain kinds of locusts which are kosher. And the general population has lost the tradition for what they are. Taimanim, Yemenite Jews, still have this tradition, and therefore they still eat locusts. I have heard that they're not very good. So Yemenites do eat locusts.
So if an Ashkenaz goes to a Yemenite home and they serve locusts, can an Ashkenaz eat them?
I think that the assumption usually is no.
No.
It's a personal issue. What is my actual Masorah in terms of this? So I think not.
Hang on. If
I know Ashkenazim have eaten them,
yeah, but
so
if,
I don't
if,
know.
If a Rav, a Sephardi Rav, eats a locust, then you could follow him by saying that's kosher. He could say it's kosher and you could eat it.
So I think the way this breaks down, I mean, and I'm not, this is kind of complicated, this issue about Masorah, is that you have a personal Masorah, which devolves out of your lineage, out of the community where you're from, and so on. It used to be more fluid. People would move to a place and take on all the customs of that place, because how are you going to maintain all of your old customs? That's why there's a lot of Sephardi people that are named Ashkenazi. I think that's the historical basis. They're Ashkenazi Jews that moved to Sephardi towns where they were called the Ashkenazi, or whatever, the Ashkenazi guy, but they took on the Sephardi customs because that's what you did. Today, it's less, things are more rigid, and I think even in general, we say that if you don't have a Masorah, so we don't know what this is, and there are people today, people don't eat turkey, people don't eat bison, and all kinds of other things, because there's no Masorah.
We don't drink rye, my friend.
We drink rye, my friend.
No tradition.
No tradition. What do you want?
Always rye. It's very interesting if you read these through ahead and you read the second one and it refers to the one right above it and you think that doesn't make any sense, but then you read the third one and he says the second one
the
is
The short
rye.
Story about fish and milk is that it might be just a scribal error.
Yeah, that's what's
It's explicitly stated in the Torah that you're allowed to eat fish and milk. All right, the Torah is like the first sort of pre-halachic discussion. And the Beit Yosef, when he discusses that, says, yes, you're allowed to eat fish and milk in terms of the halachas of meat and milk, but you should be careful not to eat fish and milk because of danger, as I mentioned in Or Chaim in section 173. If you look there, he doesn't say anything about milk. He says you're not allowed to eat fish and meat, which is what we've discussed. And so how to deal with that forks into two roads. The Ashkenazi, generally speaking, the consensus amongst the Ashkenazi poskim is it was a mistake. He meant to say meat. It was a mistake.
So how can you have a tuna milk then if you follow the
And the Sephardi psak in many Sephardi communities is that you cannot eat tuna melts. And there is some leeway in terms of butter is different than milk, which is different than cheese, and there's a variety of views, but that's a real issue for Sephardim. That's another reason why the OU, the kind of core fish labels exist, is because if you're Sephardi, you need to know if it has fish in it, because you might use it with milk, and that's also problematic. Okay, that's the short version of that.
By the way, right.